From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! As an official apology for slavery loses steam, anthropologists find evidence that slaves were worked to death. President Clinton signs a bill to bail out Washington, D.C., but critics charge the cost is democracy. And the heat is on, the high-stakes battle over Earth's threatened climate. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Another execution, this time in Arkansas. Eugene Wallace Perry proclaimed his innocence in the shooting deaths of a jeweler and his daughter, recited a Buddhist chant, and then was executed by injection. Perry claimed another death row inmate, Marion Pruitt, committed the slayings, and Pruitt has confessed to the killings. Courts rejected Pruitt's claims, however, and refused to toss out Perry's conviction. Ruth Morrison, the wife and mother of the two killed in the 1980 robbery, watched the execution last night on closed-circuit television. After the execution, she said, "I've waited 17 years for this day. I felt like justice was served, very sadly. But closure," she said, "I'm still not sure what that is." 4 days into a costly strike, United Parcel Service and the Teamsters Union have agreed to talk again. Under prodding from a federal mediator, bargainers have agreed to meet in Washington today. The union says it's not optimistic because it says there's no sign the company has changed its attitude on the issues, including more full-time workers. UPS, meantime, has sent letters to its customers urging them to push President Clinton to intervene to end the strike. Sewage sludge spread on farmlands in many parts of the country poses no health threat despite containing small amounts of heavy metals. This, according to a federal environmental official. Federal rules governing the use of sludge as fertilizer are overly stringent, said Alan Rubin of the Environmental Protection Agency. But environmentalists worry the misuse of sludge, which comes from sewage treatment plants, could contaminate water, ruin the nutrient balance of soil, or result in higher levels of heavy metals, such as lead, in vegetables or farm animals. Consumers who buy the produce or citizens living near farms using sludge as fertilizer could face health problems, they fear. Defense closing arguments are set today in the trial of Arizona Governor Fife Symington. Symington faces 21 counts of bank fraud, attempted extortion, and perjury stemming from a 5-year federal probe of his finances. If convicted on even one of the charges, he could be kicked out of office and face a long prison term. In closing arguments yesterday, prosecutors painted Symington as an intelligent and calculating developer who inflated his worth to get millions of dollars in loans he didn't pay back. Symington built about 24 office buildings and shopping centers, and all but one has been sold at a loss, foreclosed upon, or returned to lenders. The case could go to the jury tomorrow. A biotechnology company yesterday announced it had cloned a bull using a new, highly advanced technique, but declined to reveal how the method differs from existing technologies. The first clone, produced by ABS Global, which specializes in cattle reproductive science in Wisconsin, was a black and white Holstein born 6 months ago. The calf is named Jean. A soldier infected with the AIDS virus was sentenced to 6 years in prison at Fort Benning, Georgia, for having unprotected sex with 3 women in violation of direct orders that he use a condom and warn sex partners about the disease. One of the women has tested positive for the virus. The others will have to be tested for 2 years. Sergeant Robin Bellamy was dishonorably discharged and sentenced Tuesday after pleading guilty to assault, sodomy, and other charges. Yasser Arafat has warned Palestinians that crippling Israeli sanctions will only get worse and told them to prepare for battle. Some apparently already have started. In the West Bank city of Ramallah, members of Arafat's Fatah faction of the PLO burned Israeli and U.S. flags yesterday during a graduation ceremony for a course in weapons handling and street combat. North and South Korea showed little sign of compromise yesterday in four-nation talks pressing for a final peace treaty on their divided peninsula. U.S. and Chinese officials attending the pivotal talks said they're expected to resume today and might not end until tomorrow. The meetings began Tuesday at Columbia University in New York. The goal is to agree on a time, place, and agenda for a conference to forge a new security arrangement to replace the 1953 armistice that ended fighting in the Korean War. Sources in both Korean delegations describe the atmosphere at the meetings as good and businesslike. And South African President Nelson Mandela is calling for the release of East Timorese rebel leader Xanana Gusmao, who is serving a 20-year sentence in an Indonesian jail. The call has provoked an angry response from the Indonesian dictator Suharto. The South African leader is offering to negotiate a settlement of the 22-year Indonesian occupation of East Timor, which has resulted in the death of 200,000 Timorese. And you're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton this week backed off the idea of apologizing to African Americans for slavery. At the same time, the original sponsor of a congressional bill calling for the apology, Democratic Representative Tony Hall of Ohio, acknowledged that his proposal would not be approved anytime soon. Meanwhile, the first phase of a $20 million study of slave skeletons from New York City's recently discovered African burial ground indicates that many of them, even children, were literally worked to death. Joining us now is Dr. Michael Blakely, a professor of anthropology at Howard University in Washington, D.C. He's director of the New York African Burial Ground Project. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. Why don't you tell us first what exactly the bones you have studied from the African burial ground, or Negro burial ground as it was known in New York City, have indicated?
Well, the New York African burial ground is the earliest and largest African cemetery in North America that's available for study. People who were buried there were buried during the late 1600s and throughout the 18th century. And we think that there may have been 10 to 20,000 burials originally as a result of a U.S. General Services Administration building project. 400 human skeletons were excavated archaeologically, and we have those at our laboratory at Howard for under examination. Now we're in about the fourth year of a six-year project. Well, we have an opportunity to examine the actual human remains of the people who had been enslaved in New York. And our methods are broad. They extend from molecular genetics to African art history. But much of the work that we do is very similar to the work of forensic scientists studying who are interested in identifying human remains and determining what had happened to those individuals, the causes of death, and so forth. We've discovered at this point that 50% of the population died by the age of 12. And so that one in every two children died as children. And that there's a very high frequency of evidence of malnutrition among the children, very high frequencies of infectious disease as well throughout the population. The mortality figures are very very powerful for us. We think that this is a very strong indicator of the physical quality of life. About 30% or 40% of those children who died in infancy. But the other thing that is compelling, it seems, at this point in the study, at any rate, is the evidence of work and load-bearing stress. For example, one of the ways in which we determine the difference between a male and a female skeleton are the muscle attachments. The male muscle attachments tend to be larger as a result of the kinds of work that men do. We're finding that the women in the African Burial Ground Project in the African burial ground population have muscle attachments that are as enlarged as in men, so that if we did not have the pelvis, if we didn't have other very specific sex indicators in the skeleton, we would easily misconstrue the women for men.
Dr. Michael Blakey, I wanted to ask you to comment on this one particular case. I'm looking at the New York Daily News, an article this week that talks about a heartbreaking example of the stunted, horrific lives led by many of the slaves, the medical history of a six-year-old boy known only as number 39. His teeth and bones tell his age and a medical history that includes malnutrition, anemia from birth, serious infection, indications of unusually developed muscles from heavy lifting and fractures of his neck bones indicating major trauma from carrying large loads on his head. Just what you're saying about the indications of being worked to death.
Arguably, this child was worked to death. Certainly this child was enslaved in New York, and it was those conditions of his enslavement or hers that led to the various physical evidence that we see, and which ultimately led to death at age six.
You also mm-hmm. point out, for example, in this case, the article says, number 39 was buried in the 1700s by someone who obviously loved him. He was interred, among others, stacked five deep in a cedar coffin wrapped in white linen, fastened with a copper shroud pin.
It is very clear that the Africans were burying their own dead and doing it with great care, enshrouding them, in some cases burying women with their newborn children if they had died at about the same time. There are artifacts, even though it's very obvious that this is a very materially poor, economically poor population. In some cases, one, for example, a silver pendant was buried with a child, a solid silver pendant, which must have been of great value of greater value, apparently, to the living, that it be placed with the dead. So there's within that community, there's good evidence of caring, of belief in themselves as human beings, and an attempt to maintain some aspects of their African cultural traditions.
Dr. Blakey, they are facing toward Africa? They're buried facing toward Africa?
Most of the burials do face, the heads are oriented towards the west, and which can be interpreted as facing the east. And there are some which are oriented differently, and our analysis of this and its significance is not complete at this point.
What do you think of the call by some to return these skeletal remains to Africa?
Well, we Howard University are taking an engaged approach, a publicly engaged approach to this kind of science. We assume that the descendant community, the African-American community in this case, primarily involving New York leadership, has the right to determine the disposition of the remains. And our research is based on permission from that community. So these matters of reinterment and so forth have to be determined by the New York community and by and the African-American community as a whole to some extent. At this point, reinterment has been decided to take place at the original burial site in New York once our research is completed about the year 2000 with a memorial. I am actually this month going to Geneva to speak to the UN.
The UN Human Rights Commission?
Yes, by invitation for the second year to talk about the African Burial Ground Project, because there is great interest internationally and especially among the African community of nations. So they will probably be involved, the various African nations may be involved in the establishment of the memorial or the ceremonies that will take place
in New York. We're talking to Dr. Michael Blakey, who is a professor of anthropology at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and director of the New York African Burial Ground Project. Now, it's very interesting how these bones were found in New York. The 427 sets of human remains were unearthed near New York City Hall 6 years ago during excavation for a new federal building. The site is believed to be the graveyard for as many as 20,000 slaves. We've had calls from people in different areas who are saying they're trying to find out if there were Negro burial grounds in their areas. It was discovered here in New York because of this excavation project. How can people find out if they have such burial grounds in their area around the country?
Well, there are African and African American burial grounds throughout the country. Wherever people lived, they died and were buried. And African Americans, or Africans as we refer to them in the colonial period, were involved in every aspect and every part of North America, of the Americas. And I would simply say that most black communities, families, know something about the African or African-American burial grounds in their areas, although much of this information has been suppressed or buried simply by the kind of neglect that we see in New York. The African burial ground was covered up filled over with soil and built over during the 19th century, when African Americans had little influence or control over their lives, and nearly forgotten. And then, even when rediscovered due to the construction project, there was an attempt to deal with the cemetery expeditiously, which would have potentially eliminated the information and the cemetery. And all of these processes of disregard and disrespect of cemeteries sort of reflect a broader disregard and disrespect not only for the African American community, but for the African American past. And here we have an example of a sort of literal covering up of the history of African Americans and of the evidence of the atrocities of white supremacy taking place today.
Dr. Blakey, can you tell us about the Ghanaian delegation that came to the United States to apologize?
Yes, 2 years ago, a royal delegation of Ghanaian chiefs visited the United States under the banner of their a symbol called an Adinkra symbol, the Hankra, which means to reunite the house. And their effort was to build bridges between Ghana and African Americans, and they realized that in order to do that, in order to build these cultural and economic and political bridges, they would need to apologize for the participation of some African leaders, as they put it, in the slave trade, and to atone for that. In their tour, they visited our laboratory when we were able to share with them our findings about our common ancestors and even show them an Adinkra symbol from the African burial ground called Sankofa, from the same culture, which means that one can correct one's mistakes and look to the past to inform the present and the future. So I think that was a very noble gesture and courageous one on the part of the Ghanaian government and for people who were not as much involved in the slave trade as were the English and the United States, though clearly many African societies had significant involvement.
Given that apology, Dr. Blakey, what do you think of this whole controversy over an official apology from the U.S. government to African Americans for slavery that does seem to be losing steam with Tony Hall, who introduced it, and not getting a lot of support and so backing off, and now President Clinton in the last week in an interview with Black Entertainment Television clearly backing off?
Yes, I thought the I think the debate has been very interesting. I think that a lot has come out of the woodwork as a result of this question, and the Washington Post article from Tuesday by Michael Fletcher, I think, was very revealing. Essentially, it seems that African Americans feel that this apology involves too little. To have an apology without any substantive reparations or even commitment to improving the obvious discrimination in this country would seem shallow. On the other hand, for Euro-Americans, for whites, the apology seems to ask for too much. And I think what's most revealing is what we're seeing coming from the Euro or white American community that is clearly locked in denial, the kind of denial that is fed by the distortions of history. Even the African burial ground, although we have an Office of Public Education in New York and have seen 70,000 visitors and trained teachers and so forth, the African presence in New York, their contributions, the effects of slavery are still not discussed systematically in the New York public school system.
Dr. Blakey, we have to wrap up, but I wanted to ask if people want to find more out about the New York African Burial Ground Project, is there a number that they can call?
Yes, thank you. Our Office of Public Education and Interpretation in New York is at area code 212-432-5707, and our laboratory in Washington is at 202-806-5252.
I want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, that number in Washington, 202-806-5252. We've been speaking with Dr. Michael Blakey, professor of anthropology at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and director of the New York African Burial Ground Project. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. President Clinton signed into law this week a sweeping congressional measure that shifts control of municipal government in Washington, D.C., away from the elected mayor and a 13-member city council to an appointed financial control board. The bill, which has sparked heated protest, essentially provides the financially strapped city with some $1 billion in federal aid over the upcoming years. But in return, the people of the District of Columbia lose almost completely the right to elected self-government. Just a couple hours after President Clinton signed the sweeping congressional measure that shifted the control of Washington's major city agencies from the mayor and city council to the city's financial control board, the board replaced four top department heads and said it would review whether to keep five others. And as the signing and the dismissals, also led to a new round of noisy protests by city residents, who ever since the bill's passage late last month have increasingly been expressing anger at what some have termed the death of democracy in the governance of the District of Columbia. Among the protesters at the financial board meeting was Reverend Graylin Ellis Hagler of Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ, who promised to stage more demonstrations in coming days and weeks, particularly after Congress returns from its summer recess in early September. Ellis Hagler is accusing the Republican-controlled Congress of immoral treatment of the most democratic city in the country, criticized the president for going along, and then declared it's not over, democracy was crucified today, but there will be resurrection. And joining us from Washington, D.C., is Reverend Graylin Ellis Hagler, and we welcome you to Democracy Now!
Thank you very much.
So can you explain exactly what has happened? I mean, this is a national audience, but I think this has clearly national significance.
Well, basically, the act that was signed into law by the President of the United States is called the National Capital Revitalization and Self-Government Improvement Act, and we basically feel that it is none of those. It strips us really of self-government or home rule. It strips the mayor of the authority and the political power that the mayor has. It really strips the city council of the power that they have, and it strengthens a federally appointed control board to govern the city. And therefore, it is a part that control board is appointed by Congress, and citizens of the district have very little influence or ability to really even lobby such a control board.
We're also joined by Washington, D.C. Congressmember Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is the non-voting representative from the District of Columbia. Congressmember Norton, can you tell us how this happened?
In the way things often happen in the Senate, at the last minute, a anti-home rule attachment by North Carolina Senator Locke Faircloth was accepted by the Republican leadership in a room in which I was not allowed to enter as a Democrat. The fact is that the same bill got out of the House, where I, of course, am a member, without any of this. It didn't have any of these anti-home rule management. In fact, it had no management part on it at all. It left the council in its full place and didn't have any thing that anyone objected to. In fact, when it got out of the House, it was ho-hum because everybody had heard about the president's package. President's package is very much needed. It takes $5 billion in pension liability off of us and state functions that the city asked to be taken off. So things were going well until it got to the Senate. And in the Senate, it was never introduced. This gave enormous power to Locke Faircloth. It was never introduced because by the time it got to the Senate, it was going to become a part of this large budget package that had just been passed, or it wasn't going to be passed at all. It probably couldn't have been passed as a standalone bill because it had too much relief in it for the district to get the kind of to get votes that that from the Senate. And there were negotiations in which I was fully involved. All along, indeed, Locke Faircloth had a city manager on the table that would have completely taken the power of the mayor, and I was able to push that back off with a counterproposal that the mayor and I agreed upon to use some management approach that is already being used in the city, except use it in a larger number of agencies.
Congressmember Norton, there has been a lot of confusion about your role in this and what you were supporting. I've been going through all of your press releases and then also going through the Washington Post, which first said that you supported this, but you point out in your press releases, and as you're saying now, that the reason you didn't talk about Faircloth's proposals that strip the District of Columbia of Democratic rule is because you didn't think that they were going to pass. Is that right?
Well, wait a minute. I supported and indeed worked like a beaver for the financial aspects of this package.
Right.
The problem with the discussion of this package is that the attachments are discussed as if they were a part of the package. They were attached to the package. Up until the last night, I was trying to supplant part of Faircloth's language with counter language. And indeed, thought I had a chance of doing that because many of those who were going to be in the room carried my language into the room. I did have some support from senators that were going in the room for retaining home rule. As it turns out, when the ink was dry, and this was apparently filed at 3 a.m., and even when it was filed the next day, it was not clear that some of my language had not gotten in. In any case, it is now clear that it did not. And what we have here is, on the one hand, what the district most wanted, which was relief from state functions, and on the other hand, what the district most dreaded, which was the loss of much of their home rule.
So is there any redress right now? Is there any way to change this? I mean, you have, in addition to the bill, the Financial Control Board immediately moving in and removing a number of city officials.
First of all, the control board has made a major blunder. It's gone beyond even the harsh Faircloth language. The Faircloth language puts the control board in charge of these management this management part to try to bring in experts and teams to help, in fact, do something about the management of these agencies. But it doesn't take operational day-to-day control from the mayor. What the control board has done is to take some language that they got into prior appropriations and combine it with the Faircloth attachment, and they have taken full operational control of some agencies. The Faircloth language allowed the mayor to nominate and the control board to approve. The control board, you didn't hear the mayor nominating anybody. They conferred with him, but they themselves announced who these people would be. In other words, you have a control board that is, I'm not saying what they're doing is illegal, because if you put these various powers together, perhaps this is legal. But I don't think anybody in their right mind would want to leave the elected mayor out of the room, and that's what they're doing now. So he had said, this is a terrible anti-democratic thing, but I'm going to make it work. They put him out of the room, making it very difficult to make it work. He knows where the bodies are, and they don't. Hmm. This morning's paper, another paper in D.C. this morning, talks about chaos in agencies, because the Washington Times here says that people don't know who's in charge, and when they called the control board to find out the names of who was in charge, they didn't even know the first names of some of the people. Unless they strike up a partnership with the elected mayor, they will cause further division in an already greatly divided city. Doesn't have to be that way. I've got to seek redress through the president, who's agreed to meet with me, and through the Congress. Meanwhile, this control board has got to come to an understanding of how to operate, when there's been this kind of coup that's been affected. There doesn't have to be nearly as much of a coup as they're making it. And I have asked the chairman of the D.C. subcommittee, Tom Davis, if he would ask the control board and the mayor to meet with him and me, and he has indeed agreed to do that. I believe we're going to be meeting on Friday. We've got to bring some sanity back to the insanity of the retraction of home rule.
We're talking to D.C. Congressmember Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is a non-voting representative from the District of Columbia. And I actually want to ask you about that in just a minute, because I don't think people realize when they hear that you're a congressmember that you actually can't vote in Congress. But we're also joined by Reverend Grayland Ellis Hagler of the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ in Washington, D.C., a member of Clergy Against Attacks on Home Rule, which is an organization composed of independent churches and religious associations who advocate self-government in the district. What are your plans now? I mean, the bill has been passed and signed off on, and we see the Financial Control Board moving ahead full force and firing a number of city officials.
Well, a few things. One thing is that I think what Congresswoman Norton really outlined has been the flagrant disregard and disrespect for elected officials representing the District of Columbia. They disrespected Councilwoman Norton. They've disrespected the mayor, the city council. And in all that, that means that they have disrespected the people who live in the district. They continue to ram down our throats congressional plans and say to us that basically we elected the wrong people. And what we really need to say back to Congress, and are going to say back to Congress in a very strong way, is whether you believe that we made the wrong choice or the right choice is not your issue. The fact is, we have the right to choose. That's the way democracy works. And therefore, one of the things that we are planning to do is that when Congress reconvenes, we want to surround our delegate on Capitol Hill, Sister Eleanor Holmes Norton, and go with her up on that hill and make sure that everyone up there understands that there are citizens and people and preachers and believers and non-believers in the district that stand with her and hold her on our shoulders, and we will push forth with her in terms of the restructuring of this act so that it is so that it benefits the District of Columbia and it does not strip us of power, it does not economically hurt us, that it really moves us forward as a district to really begin to do the things that we need to do and deliver the services that we need to deliver.
Now, apparently some polls are showing that the people of D.C. do support this move. The idea that they've been run down so much and the city finances are so out of control that anything would do.
What poll are you talking about? Because the only poll I know of is a poll in which they asked people to phone in, and the people phoned in from Maryland, Virginia, and D.C. And I don't know of any poll that's been taken since this occurred. Do you? I mean, are you referring to something?
I'm just referring to local television, and they may just be referring to what you just described.
Yeah, that was a poll where anybody could call in. I assure you that this city, that by taking home rule from a city that only got it back after 100 years in 1974, you have hundreds of thousands of people who oppose what happened in the Congress. Now, you got to separate out that from the plan itself. Sure, people will say they want these state functions taken off of them. Sure, they will say that they want $5 billion in $5 billion in pensions liability, which was accrued by Congress and was not their own liability taken off of them. The confusion here often lies between talking about the Faircloth amendments or the Faircloth attachments and the plan itself. The Faircloth attachments are best understood if you think about attachments in the appropriation process. D.C. gets attachments in its appropriation process against abortion and stuff like that every time our appropriation goes through. That is what this is like. And that is what I would dare say the great majority of Washingtonians oppose.
Let me ask a question about the death penalty. I don't think the death penalty has come up in this, but it is an issue with D.C. because there was a referendum, is that right, in D.C., where people voted 2-1 against the death penalty. But a number of those in Congress, namely Senator Kay Bailey Hutchison, is pushing for Congress to pass a law, and this is another example of where democracy doesn't rule in D.C., that would override that referendum and actually enforce the death penalty in the District of Columbia.
I mean, can you imagine in the most local of concerns in a federal democracy is criminal law? The notion that the death penalty could be imposed on a local jurisdiction from the Congress of the United States would be unthinkable if it were any other place. And yet Kay Bailey Hutchison has put a bill in the Senate, and she's even got a co-sponsor in the House, Susan Molinari, who's left now. But I just have to hope that the work we're doing over and the vigilance we have here will keep that from coming up. I hope it will not be attached to the appropriation. Interestingly, I approached Senator Faircloth about her bill. She is on the D.C. Appropriation Committee in the Senate. I approached him and was told, no, this would not go on our appropriation. Now that he has taken so much of our home rule, I obviously can't trust to that word. But that would be the next earthquake.
And that's the issue, is that if we continue to accept any further erosion, the fact of the matter is what's to come, it gets bigger and bigger, and Congress is able to force its will upon us in a very devastating way. And so that's why we got to continue to resist, and that's why we're attempting to organize and continuing in organizing. And the issue that is coming before us is that people are going to be dealing with civil disobedience. People are going to be dealing with disruption, as you saw the other day at the control board meeting. And that is the continual push that's going to have to happen, because when our representative doesn't have a vote on the Hill, and our mayor is stripped of powers, and even the city council is stripped of powers by by Congress, then the people have no other power in their hands other than to organize, to resist, to disrupt, and to go to jail for what they believe.
Well, it's certainly, Reverend Hagler could not be more right. I'm sitting in my office now where I'm looking at pictures from the home rule era. And very frankly, we wouldn't have had home rule if civil rights activists and Washingtonians hadn't decided essentially to engage in protest. They weren't just coming down. In fact, they had resisted home rule for 100 years. So there's no question that what they've done is to bring out the protest spirit in Washingtonians. I do want to add that I just want to read to you from the first paragraph from one of the Washington papers this morning, because I think we have to use all of the strategies at our disposal. As President Clinton yesterday said, he will review the federal assistance plan for the district and try to keep it consistent with home rule, even if that means making changes in the legislation he signed Tuesday. We've got to call on the president and got to use his leverage. We have got to rally the Black Caucus when it gets back here. We've got to go in and get, and do some things in the short run. Reverend Hagler spoke about even taking some of the council's power. I think we might be able to get that back. It's only the confirmation of the whoever our appointees. I don't even that might even have been unintended, but I'm going to have a bill to do that in September. And then, of course, there is the question of what strategy do you use to get back the power that has been taken. And I'm already beginning to think that through, because I do think that since these agencies are having experts to come in the way they came into the police department, and in the police department, everybody worked together, the mayor and the control board, and we saw almost immediate improvement. I think we might, my thinking now involves a bill that over the next year would allow various aspects of home rule to come back as these agencies show improvement, rather than waiting the 4 years of the control period
DC
living with this kind of despotism.
Eleanor Holmes Norton, we do have to break now. I want to thank you very much for joining us, the D.C. Congressmember Eleanor Holmes Norton, and also Reverend Grayland Ellis Hagler of the Plymouth Congregational United Church of Christ. Can you give us a phone number if people around the country are interested in this issue where they can get in touch with you?
Well, my office number is 225-8050. And
that's
I appreciate
202-225-8050.
Yes.
And Reverend Ellis Hagler?
Yes, the number in which you can call is 202-723-5330.
That's 202-723-5330, and Reverend Hagler is a member of the Clergy Against Attacks on Home Rule. I want to thank you both very much for joining us. Thank you. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, and we'll be back in 60 seconds. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I am Amy Goodman. Before we move to our last subject, the high-stakes battle over the Earth's threatened climate, we wanted to play some listener comments made over the last few days in response to the show we had on Tuesday, which was a debate on Scientology. This is what some of you had to say.
This is Marlene Goodman from Los Angeles, California. Commenting number one on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which is probably the most wonderful program I have ever heard in my life. Exposes everybody to things that they just never really knew about before. In particular, we got to the program on Scientology. My experience with Scientologists and with the Church of Scientology has been that they are like a bunch of separate people that have been indoctrinated. And they walk around in some kind of daze. One would have to only visit their facility here, which is not their church, but their hotel. And everyone there kind of looks alike. They act alike. They almost wear the same clothing. They are absolutely, definitely incarnations of the separate people. And that's my comment. And thank you so much for your show.
My name is Dan Howard, and I live in West Stockbridge, Massachusetts. I have been a member of a number of cults, religious organizations, and have moved pretty deeply into many of the practices that I believe Scientology is involved in. And it sounds to me that both what Scientologist folks are saying and what the people critical are saying are true. I've been through the depression and that, and at this point, the work is integrating back in back into real world my altered state experiences. That's basically it.
Hi, my name's Mark, and I'm listening to KPFK, and I live in Wildomar, California. And I was wanted to comment on the program on Dianetics. And I had one time filled out one of their questionnaires, and when they call you in to evaluate them, they're you're encountering the I encountered the most high pressured type of sales techniques that I'd ever encountered in my life. And in my opinion, no religion can be based on anything. How can you ever find any spirituality behind someone else forcing you into directions? And I believe that, you know, as far as that, whether it's a religion or not, that's up to an individual to decide. But in my opinion, it's not something for anybody to go into who are seeking their own spiritual base or their own center. Thank you. Bye.
Hello. My name is Webster Moore. I'm calling from Los Angeles. I'm not a Scientologist, but I have used the techniques of Scientology. I have taken their courses on the study techniques. I've taken their workshop on communication. I sought out those training techniques as a counselor at the university as well as a teacher. I have used those techniques in the classroom to help students understand how to be a student and how to study. I can't understand how anything could be wrong with that. I've used the communication techniques, which just teaches you how to put your attention on who you are talking with and who you are listening to, really learning how to listen. I can't imagine what's wrong with that. I think what really bothers me is how anything that it seems that anything one is doing outside of Christianity is looked upon as though there's something wrong with it. There's no complaints about Catholicism. There's no complaints about, I mean, we can go on and on about the religious programs that have their own books and have their own techniques and their own everything. But you don't get those same kind of complaints because that's Christianity. So I assume that this is why there's such a force against something like Scientology, because they're just not.
Well, I want to thank everyone who has called in. We got many more calls than this. And again, if you'd like to comment on any show that was a particularly contentious show on Scientology, you can call us at 202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. We'd love to hear what you think about the whole issue of D.C. home rule or lack of it. Also, the issue of the African burial ground in New York City and what it has shown about slaves being worked to death. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move on to another issue, delegates from all over the world are meeting in Bonn, Germany this week to continue five-year-old negotiations aimed at reducing emissions of so-called greenhouse gases, namely gases that create an increase in the Earth's temperature with potentially devastating consequences. The most important of these is carbon dioxide, which is produced by burning fossil fuels. The negotiations are slated to continue until the end of the year, when world leaders will meet in Kyoto, Japan, in December to sign a greenhouse deal. But the restrictions on greenhouse gases have been sharply opposed by some major industries, specifically those that rely on fossil fuels like coal and oil. In fact, industry leaders met with President Clinton in Washington this week to press the administration on the issue. Joining us now is Ross Gelbspan. He's author of The Heat Is On, The High Stakes Battle Over Earth's Threatened Climate, joining us from Boston from the studios of WGBH. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. Yeah, thank you for having me on the program.
Well, why don't you tell us about this industry opposition, although it does look like some industry is cracking here and accepting that there has to be some restrictions on greenhouse gases.
Well, there has been a recent breaking of ranks, but there has also been, over the last 6 years, a very intense and very effective disinformation campaign by primarily big coal and big oil to keep the issue off the public radar screen. There has been a panel of more than 2,000 scientists reporting to the United Nations who determined about a year and a half ago that, in fact, Heating is happening. It's due to the burning of oil and coal. We are already experiencing the early stage of global warming, which is a much more unstable climate with rising sea levels and altered rainfall patterns and more droughts and more severe storms and so forth. But the oil and coal industry has been just ferocious in a campaign to neutralize and marginalize these scientists. And primarily, it's fairly easy to see because the real solution to the problem is essentially to stop burning oil and coal. The science tells us that to stabilize the climate, we have to cut our emissions by 70%. So what you have here is the largest enterprise in history, a $2 trillion a year business, basically fighting for its own survival. And that's why you've seen this. I can give you a couple of quick examples if you'd like.
Yes, go ahead.
Sure. In 1991, a large coal operation called Western Fuels was very candid in its annual report, and it said it was going to attack mainstream science. It hired three so-called greenhouse skeptics, scientists who didn't believe that this was happening. And they mounted a number of public relations campaigns. One in particular is quite interesting. This was a program that called for interviews by these three scientists, radio, newspaper, and TV interviews in a campaign. And the strategy papers for the campaign said it was designed to, quote, reposition global warming as theory rather than fact. And the campaign was designed to target older, less educated men and young, low-income women in districts that get their electricity from coal and preferably have a representative on the House Energy Committee. The industry has been flooding the reporters, flooding policymakers, and flooding the public with this disinformation, and it has been extremely effective.
I thought it was interesting, a New York Times book review column on your book, The Heat Is On. You have a quote of a German journalist observing in your book, "It's only in America that there's a debate over what's happening to the global climate." The idea that there's a real debate here about whether greenhouse gases affect the environment.
It's absolutely true. And this targeting campaign has really taken place in the U.S. more than anywhere else because the U.S. is the leader. And whatever the U.S. decides in these climate negotiations that you referenced is really will set the tone for the action the rest of the world will take. There is enormous resistance. The Senate has been flooded with materials from oil and coal lobbies talking about huge job losses, major economic dislocations from emissions reductions. What they don't say is that if we were to do what we needed to do, which is essentially embark on a major program to change all our energy sources with renewable energy, which could give us the amount of power that we need right now. I'm not talking about any decline in our living standards, but that if that were to happen, it would create a huge boom of wealth, especially in the developing world. And these countries would provide millions and millions of jobs in the creation and installation of solar panels and windmills and fuel cells and so forth. But the oil and coal lobby is tremendously, ferociously, as I say, active in opposing that, and in particular in this country, because if the U.S. does little, it's very certain that the rest of the world will not be able to do very much.
We're talking to Ross Gelbspan, who is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. His latest book, The Heat Is On, The High-Stakes Battle Over Earth's Threat and Climate. You know, we've been covering the campaign finance abuse hearings extensively, and I wonder if this debate is going on in this country because of the role of money in politics here. You talk about the alliance between the coal and oil industry and conservative politicians to confuse the public about global warming. Is it because of the tremendous impact money plays in U.S. politics?
It is directly so, but it's also indirectly so because, as I say, the amount of media access that the coal and oil industries have spent on these few dissenting scientists, there are about six of them versus about 2,000 of the world's scientists who've reached consensus on the fact that this is happening, that money has been used to basically keep the public quiet. So the public has not put a lot of pressure on politicians. And as a result, the money that then goes into the political process has been virtually unaffected in its effectiveness in the committees and so forth.
And rarely does the media identify a scientist as being on the payroll of, say, the coal and oil industry. I know it from the whole issue of Procter & Gamble, a very different issue in Olestra, the number of scientists and professors who have somehow gotten money from Procter & Gamble, but they're never identified as such when they're coal called experts on television.
I think that's really important, and this issue of disclosure is extremely important. These scientists that I'm talking about, these dissidents who've been used by industry, have received large amounts of money from the government of Kuwait, from OPEC, from coal and oil interests. They have not disclosed this money until they were compelled to do so under oath about a year and a half ago. And as a result, reporters were not able to distinguish between those scientists and the mainstream scientists. Today, no editor or reporter would give the same weight to a tobacco company scientist as they would to a world-class lung disease specialist. But unfortunately, that learning curve hasn't caught up in the area of climate.
What about the insurance industry and the role it has played in this debate?
It's very interesting. The insurance industry may be the largest hope for a institutional counterforce to the fossil fuel lobby. The insurance industry has been seeing its losses to weather-related disasters rise by orders of magnitude. In the 1980s, they were losing an average of $2 billion a year to weather disasters. In the 90s, it is $12 billion a year. The president of the American Reassurance Association said recently that unless something is done to stabilize the climate, it could very well bankrupt the entire industry. And so it's interesting, in the diplomatic negotiations, you see the insurance industry allied with the one group of nations that's calling for the most ambitious cuts of 20%. And this is a group of small island nations from Jamaica to the Philippines who fear being flooded out of existence by rising sea levels. So the insurance industry is beginning to become much more proactive in this issue. They are calling for the governments of the world to regulate fossil fuels and to demand and mandate emissions reductions.
Ross Gelfsben, you end your book with two chapters, The Coming Permanent State of Emergency and One Pathway to a Future. Can you talk about what this picture is of what we can see if we go along this course, and then what you see as the hope?
Amy, it's very interesting. A couple of people said to me independently that long before the systems of the planet collapse, the institutions of democracy will buckle under a series of ecological emergencies. And that is very easy to see, especially in the developing countries, where their traditions of democracy are often as fragile as their ecosystems. It's very easy to see governments resorting to martial law to deal with floods and droughts and epidemics of infectious disease and all kinds of dislocations. It's also potentially possible in this country. And so the outlook for democracy is very bad. Most people and most environmentalists don't think through the consequences of climate change to our political and social systems, and they're very, very dire indeed. The pathway to the future that you mentioned, which is my own personal solution, and it's what my reporting brought me to basically, is that what we need to do is not jockey for different levels of emissions reductions, which will cause some job losses and which will cause perpetual conflict among different industries and regions and countries trying to shift the burden onto each other. What we really need to do is basically tap into this $2 trillion a year revenue stream of oil and coal to set up windmill factories in India and photovoltaic plants in El Salvador and hydrogen gas plants in Germany and fuel cell factories in Cleveland, and essentially embarked on a 10-year program to rewire the world. That would create a huge economic boom. It would begin to narrow the gap between the North and the South, and in very short order, renewable energy would replace high tech as the central driving engine of growth of the global economy. But it would also mean the virtual extinction of big coal and big oil.
Well, Ross Gelfsben, that's quite a mouthful, and I want to thank you very much for joining us. His book is The Heat Is On, The High Stakes Battle Over Earth's Threatened Climate. It is published by Addison Wesley. It's brand new. And just ending on this comment that Ross points out in his book, The Heat Is On, a relentless stream of news reports about record-setting weather extremes in the last several years reflects the new period of climatic instability we've entered. Unfortunately, the media doesn't talk about these natural disasters as related to global warming. For example, in the summer of 1995, the Midwest experienced its second 100-year flood in just 3 years. And shortly thereafter, at least 300 people died in a brutal heat wave in Chicago. We've got to rethink these things and talk about them, put them in the context they should be put. Well, Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin with help from Leslie George. Errol Maitland engineered from New York at WBAI. Andy York is our Washington engineer at WPFW. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to reach us by email, our address is democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!